Bam, and welcome to the Sustainable Living Program, where we are adapting to the ongoing, and as we've heard on NPR, the increasing threat due to the pandemic. I'm Jungle Jay. I'm phoning it in today from my suburban jungle homestead in Clearwater. In the studio today is my co-host, Tanya Vidovic, and manning the electronics, as usual, is Rob Lori. I'd like to start by thanking our listener sponsors who make this completely non-commercial community-supported radio station at WMNF and this little program possible. Every other week, we try to bring you experts on topics that affect the world in which we live. Please visit WMNF.org online. Check out the Sustainable Living link and share any topics that you are interested in, and we will provide that forum. Like the page to receive notifications. On our program today, we are going to be discussing what has been historically maligned and often feared creature. And in reality, it's integral to the health of our ecosystem. And as I said, we have two experts today. So joining us also remotely to educate and maybe demystify these flying mammals are Mimi Jenkins and Shannon Carnival. Mimi is a biologist focused on conservation ecology and sustainable agriculture. She holds a PhD in wildlife biology from Clemson University, where she studied methods of diversifying farm landscapes to support wild pollinator communities. She has worked in conservation initiatives ranging from monitoring sea turtles in remote parts of Costa Rica to protecting spotted owls in Oregon. One of her primary goals is to spread awareness of conservation issues and to increase transparency of scientific research to the general public. Shannon Carnival is a natural resources and conservation agent for the University of Florida IFAS Extension, Polk County. She has an MS of Agricultural Education and Communication and a BS in Forest Resource Management from the University of Florida. Shannon's extension program focuses on water resources, coexisting wildlife, and protecting and enhancing our local environments. Her systems-based approach to natural resource management aims to improve the relationship between local communities and the environment in which they exist. So, welcome Mimi and Shannon to WMNF Sustainable Living Program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you for having us.
And it's wonderful to have you join us to kind of elucidate a little bit on, as I said, this sort of mysterious flying mammal. So let's jump right in and talk about, you know, why are bats so feared and maligned?
So bats have long been portrayed as evil or dangerous in Hollywood. I mean, you can think of literary references like Dracula, and in pop culture, people are afraid they carry diseases. They fly, they only come out at night, they're dark in color, making them challenging to see. It's not a big stretch to understand how they fit in with the spookiness of the Halloween timeframe.
Okay, so are there any reasons that we should fear bats? You know, we hear that they might carry rabies and those kind of things. But is there any basis really in fact for that fear?
I can jump in. So bats do carry rabies and some other viruses and diseases. However, a very, very small proportion of bats actually do are found to have rabies. Less than 1% in some studies show that in wild populations, bats would actually harbor rabies. And for the most part, you know, as long as people are not coming into contact with bats, which they normally should never do, that risk is really, really low. You know, the risk of getting rabies from another animal like a feral cat or another species is much, much higher. And again, if that, you know, if we protect wild areas and we protect invasive species from inhabiting our areas, these types of human-wildlife conflict would be much less likely to occur. So in terms of the rabies fear, it's much overestimated, you know, kind of overstated, I think, for bats.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So they're not, it's not really an idea where bats are predatory on humans or they want to fly into our hair like we've often heard historically.
No, I would say it's not a case where you would need to be concerned with that. In addition to the low level of rabies occurring in the bat population, unlike other mammals, when you think of how they get rabies and they can be aggressive, bats tend to be lethargic or disoriented. And so you're not going to have that big run-in with a rabid bat. Instead, you might find them crawling around on the floor looking ill. And so it's important, like Mimi said, to never pick up a bat that you might find on the ground and handle them, because there's a chance that that bat you found on the floor is sick and it might be rabies. But you're unlikely to have that encounter. If you just look at some of the newspaper headlines, you might be more afraid of bats having rabies, because it is true that they are the second most common species when you look at the Florida Department of Health list of number of tests that a species has had test positive. Over the last 20 years, bats are routinely the second highest number of positive rabies tests. But that's because they are so slow and disoriented that they're easy to catch and then get tested for rabies. But the actual threat to a person is very low for rabies.
And so other than seeing them fluttering around in the twilight when we go out in the evening, how is it likely that humans would come into contact with them other than finding one that's sick or injured on the ground? We do hear sometimes that they do get into enclosed spaces or get into your house.
Yeah, I would say that most of the phone calls I get about bats that people have come into contact with is they have accidentally gotten into a back patio, or they found bats roosting in their attic. And so it's that sort of situation where the bat is trying to find somewhere to roost or rest. And when there's a lack of natural habitat, you're likely to get a bat in a more urban situation, in a residence or an abandoned barn or a shed, something like that.
Well, I think that sort of demystifies and takes a little of the fear factor out of it. So let's move into starting to discuss what their role is in the environment and how they are beneficial to it.
Yeah, that's a really, really important. Not only are they incredibly fascinating and just really complex and highly diverse, you know, they make up about a fifth of all mammal species, actually. There's over 1,400 known species of bats. They're found all over the world. And you know, in terms of the services that they provide to people, other than just being really cool and I think worthy of protection for that reason, they provide really important pest control services to people. You know, in the U.S. alone, that's estimated to be about $3.7 billion worth of pest control, including really terrible agricultural crops. So, you know, like the corn bollworm, and you know, they also, of course, in terms of eating insects, help to reduce disease carrying insect populations like mosquitoes, and helping take down those types of vector borne diseases in areas where people are, like Zika, malaria, etc. they also, you know, are really important pollinators, not so much here in Florida. We have mostly the insectivorous species of bats, but elsewhere in the world, you know, they, for instance, we wouldn't have bananas without bats. We have bred bananas to be, you know, mostly seedless in a certain shape and size that we have today, but the wild species of bananas that we bred, the Cavendish banana that we have today, are from parts of Asia, and the flying foxes, the large megabats that exist out in Asia, are the primary pollinators of those wild banana species. And even today, you know, with the likelihood of the Cavendish banana being, you know, having serious problems with disease in the near future, having that wild genetic kind of stock of wild species out in Asia is really important in terms of the future of banana, commercial banana, you know, growing in the future. And in addition, you know, bats can really be indicator species of healthy ecosystems. Where we see bats, we tend to see that there is some healthy insect populations, which of course are the main food source for so many other wildlife as well, birds, amphibians, you know, other predators, reptiles. And so, you know, those bats can serve as sort of a healthy indicator species as well.
I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to the Sustainable Living Show here on WMNF Tampa. Today, we are talking about bats with local experts Mimi Jenkins and Shannon Carnival. If you have any questions, give us a call at 813-239-9663 or send us an email at dj@wmnf.org. Thank you.
Well, I was fascinated to hear that there are 1,500 species worldwide. That's that's news to me, and I was an evolutionary biologist, so it's, I'm really surprised to hear that number. And we do have an international listenership now via our online presence. But to focus it back down a little bit on our Florida audience, how many species might we expect to run into here in Florida? Do you know offhand?
Florida has 13 species of resident bats, and what I mean by resident are bats that are here year-round that don't migrate. So we have those 13 species that are always here, and then there are a handful of species that might be found in the very northern parts of Florida that might migrate in from some of the other states, like the gray bat. And then in very south Florida, you have another handful of species that might be coming up from some of the islands. And those species, like Mimi mentioned, are some of our pollinator and fruit bats. But all of our resident species, all 13 in Florida, are insectivores that eat at night.
Wonderful. So that means that we actually get some immigrant bats that come from the islands and maybe from Georgia, Alabama, and those kind of areas. That's interesting information. So, how many bats do we think are in the population, or do we have a metric on the numbers that we might experience? That may be too big a question.
That is a pretty big question. From what I've seen, they're estimating that 1 in 4 mammals on the planet are a bat, and then 3/4 of bat species eat insects. So it's really challenging to comprehend the amount of insects a bat could eat, but I don't have a great number for a population size number. Mimi, do you?
No, I don't. I would just add to what you said, Shannon, that in general, bats as many wildlife species are not very well understood, to be completely honest, in terms of the population sizes, in terms of many aspects of their biology. We still have so much to uncover. And with the fact that they exist in sort of, areas where they can be hard to find and they can be hard to detect, that makes it harder to understand the population numbers as well. So, yeah, unfortunately, I don't have the number for you either.
And I imagine that that research would be very difficult because they are a reclusive, secretive kind of animal that try to avoid us, I'm assuming. Let's talk a little bit. We've talked about how they are helpful in the environment with reducing insect pests and so forth. Let's talk about a little bit about the habitat that we can sort of reinforce to support that population. Where are we at to find them?
I would say in most of Florida, the biggest threat to bats is the loss of habitat or roosts being destroyed because people are afraid of them. So anything we can do to protect and enhance forested areas will help bat habitat. And then in urban areas or suburban areas, there are a lot of landscaping practices that residents can do, which will help support healthy bat populations. The best recommendation I can give for landscaping practices would be to leave your palm fronds on your palm. Don't over prune your palm trees because we have several bat species that like to roost in the folds of your palm fronds, especially the brown hanging ones down on the trunk. And similarly, try not to remove the Spanish moss that might be forming or on your trees. We also have several bat species that will roost individuals or small little colonies of 5 or 10 bats will be in a clump of Spanish moss. And at least once a year, I'll get a phone call from a resident who had a landscaping company come through and prune all their palm trees, and now they have all these bats on the ground, and they're absolutely distraught. So knowing that those two locations, Spanish moss and palm fronds, are important habitats in our urban and suburban landscape can help the general public have something that they know they can do to help protect natural bat habitat. Absolutely.
Yes, I think that's very important information. As you know, we have so many new residents moving into Florida that we can all help to educate one another on this sort of spurious aesthetic that we've developed. The lore that we create about how the Spanish moss might be killing the trees or removing the petticoats, what I call the petticoat from our state tree, the cabbage palm, which is habitat to many bats. So I think that's probably an important takeaway. And then maybe moving into a little how-to idea, what about bat houses and creating habitat for bats?
Yeah, bat houses are a great way to add artificial habitat. For Florida, we recommend mounting those on buildings or poles at least 12 feet in the air. And Florida bats will do better in a bat house that is multiple chambers. So whether you build it yourself or you purchase it from a retailer, you want something that has more than one chamber in the bat house so that the bats can freely move between the areas and pick the temperature and humidity range that is perfect for them in that moment.
And I want to remind our listeners that you are listening to the Sustainable Living Show here on WMNF Tampa. Our guests today are talking about bats. We have Mimi Jenkins and Shannon Carnevale, and Jungle Jay is interviewing them, explaining exactly why bats are important to the environment, where they live. And right now we are about to learn about bat houses and how to get bats to come to your property because they eat mosquitoes. So stay tuned if you want to learn. And if you have any questions for us, give us a call at 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org. Please continue. So if you want to give us maybe an explanation on how to make a bat house, does it take up a lot of space? Do you need to install a pole? For the average resident who wants to see an increase in bats in their yard, and maybe they don't have a palm frond and the HOA doesn't let you keep the palm fronds down, what sort of habitat and what does the house look like?
It's important first to realize that
the best place to put one
first,
don't
the best.
You guys are both talking at the same time. Oh. Let's start with Shannon and then Mimi. Would you mind jumping in if she misses anything?
Sure.
Thank you.
I'm sorry about that. Bat houses in Florida should be, like I said, above 12 feet. The best location to mount them would be on a building. So if you have a two-story house or if you have a an area in a park that might have a learning center, that's a great spot to mount them. You can always put up a pole that will you can mount the bat house to. You can put them in trees as well, but that also presents some opportunity for predators to get into them. And you'll want some, we do have some recommendations from University of Florida IFAS Extension on instructions on how to build a bat house, but you can absolutely purchase one if that's more your speed.
And for people who have never seen a bat house before, what do they look like? Do they look like a birdhouse? Like what kind of investment are they getting into? Is it a 5-foot structure or is it smaller that somebody can attach easily to their own house?
Oh, yes. Great point. The residential, like in a neighborhood, the bat house that you might put up, it looks like a flat, large rectangular square. So it should be about 2 feet tall and at least 14 inches wide, but it will be relatively flat because those chambers I'm talking about are essentially planks of wood spaced out less than 3/4 of an inch apart to provide little tiny channels for the bats to crawl up. So it won't look like a bat house, I mean a bird house, but it will have a rough house-like shape to it. And they can be as large as a community wants to build if they have a park. A great example of that would be the large bat colony house up in Gainesville. Theirs, I believe, holds something like 300,000 bats. And it looks like a house, except the bottom of it is open so that the bats can fly up into it.
It sounds like you're describing like a filing space with these chambers. That's interesting. And do the bats, if somebody gets excited and goes to your website and wants to build it themselves, does it say what type of material that they prefer?
It does. And so it talks about just having non-pressure treated wood. You do not want to use a stain or paint or anything on the inside of the house, but you will want to make it watertight. And depending on where you place the house, in full sun, full shade, somewhere in between, you'll want to paint it a nice medium brown color on the outside if the temperatures are relatively mild for Florida. So say between 75 and 95 degrees in the summer, a good medium brown color is good. And that should be done with a water-based paint or a water-based stain.
And
I was fortunate to travel to Austin, Texas, and saw the amazing flight of bats coming out from under the bridge. And it was thousands of them. And I'm assuming that they like those spaces because they are warm-blooded and small animals and need that heat sink to stay warm. Should our bat houses be placed in any particular orientation to maximize that solar gain during the day for the cool evening?
My understanding is it will depend on exactly where in Florida you are and what the other habitat near you might look like. But Mimi, do you have any more specific guidance on that?
Yeah, I would just add to what you said that I believe that they typically recommend it to be south-facing, if I do remember correctly. The amount of sunlight that the bat house receives is a little bit less important in Florida just because it is so warm here compared to the northern areas of North America where the climate is much different. And so, you know, that's not as much of a concern. Of course, not placing it in places where it's very shady is important, where it's still receiving a lot of sunlight throughout the majority of the day is important for it to maintain a good temperature. And having those chambers and having it be at least 2 feet tall will enable the bats within it to be able to move around if it does get too hot, or you know, if they need to get a little warmer, they'll move into other places within it. So all of those features of the bat house will enable, you know, will make it more likely for the bats to come. And I would just also add that it's important to to recognize too that only certain species of bats here in Florida will tend to occupy the bat houses. That being usually the Brazilian freak-tailed bat and the evening bat, and sometimes the southeastern myotis. But so those are these like opportunistic species that can easily transition to these man-made structures. But we really need to be protecting other habitat to enable these other species, like the yellow bat, that only really roost in the Spanish moss and the palm fronds. You know, so there's only certain areas that certain bats will roost in.
And again, I think that's very important information to disseminate to the public, is the absolute necessity of integrating the natural habitat for all of our species, and in this case, bats in particular. So that's, if someone was to actually find, or have a bat get into their space, if you have an infestation, say we sometimes hear about them infesting attics and stuff and so forth, should we call a wildlife rescue? And if we get one in our house, is there something that we can do to sort of help us, just help it find its way outdoors?
Mimi?
Okay, yeah. You for sure would want to try to contain it to a particular space, a particular room, and shut the door within that room. If the bat at any time was in a room alone with one of your pets or with a sleeping person that may not be aware of whether they were in contact with the bat, that is something to definitely be aware of. And if that is the case, we need to confine the bat to a particular area, try to get the bat. At that point, it might be good to call a rescue organization or Shannon might have better resources for you. In terms of that, but just to be able to make sure that rabies was not transmitted, although, like I said, the likelihood of that happening is very low, but just to be sure, because rabies is a very dangerous illness that can be fatal if not treated very swiftly. Sorry, go ahead.
If you are bit by a bat, that brings up a good point. I know it is very rare to happen, and you said only like 1% of bats carry rabies, but if you are bit by a bat, what sort of precautions should you take?
Definitely need to wash the area very well immediately. We need to do as much as possible to safely get that bat into some type of contained space in order to be able to test it for rabies. Because in that situation, if it did test positive, a person would go ahead and go through the rabies vaccination process and they would be fine. But not knowing is definitely not a risk that one would want to take. And at that point, you also want to definitely contact a physician or the county health department to sort of find out more information about what you should do at that time. But time is of the essence.
Rob, do you have any questions? I see you nodding along.
I'm just listening. We're talking about bats here on WMNF 88.5 FM. And if you've got a question about bats, and I think a lot of people are trying to cut down the mosquitoes in their backyard, and that's one good reason to have bats in your backyard, call us up, 813-239-9663, or an even better way to contact our guests, Shannon Carnival and Mimi Jenkins, you can email us here in the studio. The address is dj@wmnf.org. Let me just go through some of the questions I have. Is there a connection, Shannon, and maybe we could jump to Mimi after that, between bats and COVID-19? We had heard some stories that said that in China, the bats might have transmitted COVID-19. Is that a reason to fear bats, do you think, Shannon?
I do not think that's a reason to fear bats, especially in Florida. To my knowledge, the exact cause between bats and the virus for COVID-19 spreading to people has not been, the origin has not yet been completely identified from what I recall. There is definitely some speculation of it originating in bats in China, But from what I have heard from our experts at the university is that we don't know exactly how or when or if the virus moves from bats to some other species before it got to people. And regardless, that species of bat that they are talking about in China is not here.
And, so, and are bats normally pretty shy of humans?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, disturbing a roost could cause them to find other roosting habitats. So if you're trying to conserve bats in your area, shining a light up there or creating lots of noise, spraying water up there, those are ways that you can disturb them in a really negative way, and they will leave to avoid people.
How many mosquitoes can a single bat eat at night? And Mamie, let me toss that one to you.
I think it totally depends on the species. I would say, I know there are some species that can eat 1,000 mosquitoes or insects in one night. But it is one thing to add is that many bats actually consume moths as their primary food source, or beetles or true bugs or all the other, you know, litany of other insects, which, of course, are very plentiful in the night sky in addition to mosquitoes. But definitely they do help cut down on the mosquito populations as well.
Shannon, if I build a bat house in my backyard, do I have to do anything to attract the bats? For instance, do I put any sort of food in there, or will they just naturally come?
So that's a really hard question to answer. There won't be a space for you to put anything in it, and you don't want to put anything in the bat house. But there are some things you can do around your yard or your home to make the area better habitat. If you have access to a large body of water, say a pool or a fountain, a large fountain or of some kind, providing access to that can attract bats. You can also plant native plant species in your landscaping that might attract some of their normal diet, the moths, beetles, and flies, like Mimi was mentioning. But providing water and reducing your use of broadcast insecticides so that you're not killing off their foraging species before they can get to them are the ways that you can really help make better habitat near your bat house.
Mimi,
it could take several years.
Yeah. Mimi, let me ask you about bat guano. Is it good fertilizer? And is it, but at the same time, is it dangerous? Because I've heard it's dangerous for people that go up into church steeples and other places where there's a lot of bats roosting. And if they touch the guano, then they could be in danger if they breathe it in. But tell me about bat guano as a fertilizer.
Well, it is a very good fertilizer. It has been harvested by people for many years because of its, you know, high nutrient value for plants. That's how the nature works. You know, the waste of one thing is the food of another. I definitely would not ever recommend. In fact, I would discourage anyone from trying to harvest it in a place where bats are living. We definitely want to try to cut down as much as humanly possible on the interaction between humans and wildlife, including bats. And we want to let them be. There's other ways to fertilize or to, you know, improve the soil fertility even without using fertilizers that I would recommend before trying to do anything of that nature.
So, Shannon, let me ask you this question. And by the way, we're talking with Shannon Carnival and Mimi Jenkins, who are both experts on bats, and you're listening to WMNF 88.5 FM. And Wheezy sent in the first email. Wheezy writes, realizing there may be some variation within the 13 species of the Florida bats, what is their approximate lifespan? That's question one, lifespan. How many babies do they give birth to at one time? When do they fledge? And is there anything else you can tell us about the babies? And do bats have natural predators? And Shannon, let's start with you, and then we'll go to Mimi.
Wow. Okay, that was a lot of questions at one time. But I'll do my best to answer some of them for you. In general, the lifespan question, although we get it about every wildlife species I teach about, is a very challenging question to answer due to the number of predators and just in general, how challenging life out in the wild can be. So unfortunately, I don't have a great answer on lifespan, but I can tell you that most of our bat species in Florida have one pup or one baby bat a season or a year, But we do have several species that can have twins. For instance, the evening bat usually gives birth to twins. The pups are pink and hairless, and they don't open their eyes for 24 hours. Other species of our bats can have one pup, but might have two or three over the year. So it depends on the weather that year, how much of the food sources are doing, like how many insects they're able to get. Bats that are pregnant or nursing will eat a lot more insects, up to two-thirds of their body weight. So depending on the amount of prey available, that can alter their reproductive season as well as the temperatures that year.
So one of the other questions is, how long does it take for a baby to be born before they fly?
That is another great question. Don't have a great answer for that one. It will vary by species, but bat maternity season is April 15th through August 15th. So on the whole, for all of our species, we want to make sure that we're not doing any bat exclusions during bat maternity season. While the mating season is usually in the fall, they will not give birth to the spring. And so in that springtime, April to August, that's when you'll have nursing mothers in their roosting sites.
And the last question Wheezy had was, are there natural predators of bats?
All sorts of predators. So everything from snakes and raccoons to owls, hawks, all birds of prey. If you get a chance to go to one of these large roosting sites to watch all the bats come out just after dusk, like in Gainesville, it is a really wonderful lesson on the circle of life for children especially. It's not particularly gruesome, which is nice, but you will have all sorts of birds of prey hanging out on the fence around the bird, around the bat house, waiting for them to come out so that the hawks and things like that can go after the bats as they leave their roost.
And one last question before we go back to Tanya and to Jay. Pesticides and chemicals. Is there one particular pesticide or chemical that does harm to the bat population that you think we should be very careful when we use it?
I have a quick answer, and then I want to throw it to Mimi. In my perspective, from what I've read, the answer is no, there's not a specific herbicide that's a problem. But what I try to teach residents is to avoid broadcast insecticides, because when you use a broadcast insecticide, you're trying to kill whatever insect comes in contact with it. If you have an insect issue that needs insecticide that you can't control in any other way, try and get an insecticide that is species-specific and targets that one species or problem that you're dealing with. But I don't know if Mimi has a different perspective on that.
No, I would agree with you for the most part. I would say, yeah, insecticides are definitely the biggest threat to bats in terms of pesticides, because it attacks their food source and it could potentially have bioaccumulative effects as well in insects that are, you know, have exposure to the pesticide and still survive but have sublethal effects. So when the bats consume them, they can have impacts on their bodies as well.
And again, I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to the Sustainable Living Show here on WMNF Tampa, where we bring you a different topic of sustainability every other week. And today we are talking about bats with local experts, Mimi Jenkins and Shannon Carnival. And I wanted to know, what sort of threats do bats face right now? Like, should we be worried about their population? Are they, how are they doing?
I'll jump in.
Did you want to take
IUCN that one? Estimates that over 200 species of bats worldwide are at risk of, are endangered or threatened at this point. We do have two species of bats that are on the endangered species list now in Florida, the gray myotis and the Florida bonneted bat, which occurs a much further south in Florida. And so I would say that there's definitely, you know, evidence that bats are threatened worldwide. Some of those threats differ depending on where we are in the world. In terms of here in Florida, definitely habitat loss and destruction and fragmentation is the number one reason for species decline in general, and that would include bats. Just simply removing the places where they roost, removing important food sources like we've been talking about, which is insecticides. and really just impacting where they live and how they live, as well as other factors like disturbing their cave roost, people that may enter a cave and may want to get rid of that, or disturbing them while they're in torpor and things of that nature can really affect bats as well.
I did read that there was an increase in bats this year specifically. Is that accurate?
I can't speak to that. I mean, it might have been for certain species. You know, certain species are better adapted to human civilizations, like the Brazilian free-tailed, that are easily able to inhabit, like Jay mentioned, the bridge in Austin and places like that. So if I were to guess, it might be species like that that would actually maybe be increasing in numbers. But yeah, probably very species dependent.
You know, it's funny because my neighbor has, and I'm a part of a gardening group. I'm sure that all the listeners know that already. But it is funny because I was talking to my neighbor who's also a gardener, and he has a dragon fruit cactus. And we were discussing the increase in bats that we've seen in our neighborhood and how this is the first time in his 25 years at that house that there's fruit on that plant. And we were talking about whether or not it's because of the increase in bats because they are in the night blooming cirrus family and they're pollinated by bats. So I'm interested to see if any of our listeners also have found that they have additional fruit on their night blooming cirrus plants. So if you do find an increase, give us a call at 813-239-9663. And I do want to kind of talk about the bats and its association with Halloween because the season is upon us. Does anybody do either one of you know what the history and why bats are associated with Halloween?
I don't have an answer that's based in literature. I just have my own assumptions and opinions on it. But Mimi, do you have any literature-based or more reliable sources?
Not that I would want to, quote because I'm not a historian. I read something about a Celtic tradition that may have something to do with the bats that were being seen in the night sky in areas up north in the United States where they are highly migratory. But again, I don't want to be quoted on that because I'm not an expert. But I think that I would just echo what Shannon said earlier in the show about, you know, them being nocturnal and being seen as scary and disease-carrying and all these sort of things that people tend to fear. I think that's the primary reason, probably.
Yeah, and then
so going back to the idea of the broad spectrum or broadcast of insecticides, you know, again, many people moving to our area from northern climates, and they run into the mosquito problem here, and maybe you know, calling their municipalities and demanding the fogging. And so I'm assuming that fogging for mosquitoes would have a serious detrimental effect for the bat populations. Is that accurate?
To my knowledge, the chemicals that most municipalities use for mosquito control are highly species-specific or at least mosquito-specific. And a lot of them, especially in areas where there's a lot of water, are targeting the larvae of the mosquitoes and not necessarily the flying mosquitoes. So I know that they do look for potential impact on other species when they're approving those chemicals, but I would be more concerned with the cumulative effect of individual residents using broadcast insecticides in their yard.
Great information. And I would like to remind our listeners that we do have a Facebook presence, and many of the links that Shannon has shared with us, we will be posting on that Facebook page. And it's a wonderful way to stay abreast of what the upcoming shows will be and also to provide your input again, because we'd love to have our listeners share with us what you're interested in so that we can bring you that kind of programming. So anyway.
So, you know, what's interesting, I got interested more about bats when I heard Shannon do a presentation online, an online presentation on bats. So is there, if somebody wants to learn more about bats and kind of dive into it, where can they find that information, Shannon?
Well, our webinars were recorded. So if anyone is interested in watching that specific webinar that you tuned into, thank you for that, by the way. It is able to be found on YouTube. Probably the best way to find it would be to Google Wildlife Webinars University of Florida. They should come up on YouTube. We have a playlist. I'm happy to send you the link for that as well if you're interested.
Absolutely. And if you send them to me along with a how to build a bat house, I will post it on our Facebook page on Sustainable Living WMNF. Thank you.
Of course. I'll send them to you right after the show. I do want to give your listeners a little bit of a warning about building a bat house. If you are not a woodworker, it is a big undertaking, and you do need to buy a lot of wood. And so I will also provide a web link to the Bat Conservancy of Florida website, where they list retailers that sell bat houses that meet a certain criteria to attract bats.
That is perfect. And we actually have a couple of emails. Andrew Wilson asks, as a result of contact with a feral cat, I ended up learning a lot about rabies. A, rabies can have a very long latency period, up to years. B, the incubation period for rabies is highly variable. The notion that delaying action for 7 to 14 days is safe is false. Symptoms have developed in less than 5 days, and once symptoms appear, the disease is invariably fatal.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like, and that was Andrew from Horry County. Is there anything you would like to say? I guess that was less of a question and more of a statement.
I would just echo what you said, that rabies is a very, very serious problem. Just like Mimi Jenkins mentioned, she properly said that, you know, the first thing you should do is immediately scrub the area with soap and running water for 5 to 10 minutes. And then you immediately want to seek emergency medical care, whether it's your doctor that you have on speed dial or going to an emergency room. Even it is very important to treat that wound. And then third, if you or your doctor haven't already, call your county health department or your local animal control to give them a detailed description of what happened, so that, like Mimi said, they can test the animal in question, assuming that you still have access to it.
And is that true? So you're telling the listeners, don't wait. If you get bit by, honestly, any wild animal or mm-hmm. bat or feral cat, you don't want to wait until symptoms start. You want to seek immediate medical attention.
That's correct. That's what I would recommend. It doesn't matter if it's a snake and you're like, oh, I'll wait and see if it's venomous in case I have a reaction. No, if you get bitten by any wildlife at all, you should immediately seek medical attention to make sure that any of those, just like your emailer wrote, symptoms can be delayed, and they might not be obvious to you that symptoms are happening, but that doesn't mean harm to your body or your brain isn't happening. So always seek medical attention if you get bit by a wild critter. And it can also be from a scratch from a critter. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a bite. If you are attacked, scratched, bitten, anything by a wild animal or a feral animal, definitely seek medical attention ASAP.
And then let me see. Oh, I'm sorry. Please continue.
No, I was just going to add really quickly that in the case of rabies, actually, once symptoms have started to show, it could possibly be too late actually to treat it. And it is a fatal illness. But if you do act upon it very quickly, luckily there are vaccines in it and a protocol for treating it, even if you don't know for sure that you have rabies. So if there's even the risk that you do, you would normally go through that set of vaccinations just to be sure that you don't obviously contract the illness part of it.
Mm-hmm. And then Cheryl Webb wrote in, I think that she was trying to explain why people are fearful of bats, and she mentioned that vampires can turn into bats in the old stories. So that is probably one of the reasons why people are fearful of bats. Do you think people were fearful of bats before these stories of vampires, or do you think that the vampires kind of came from people's fear of bats?
I don't know which came first. I think that might be a chicken or the egg scenario. But I can tell you that in other cultures around the world, some Asian cultures, bats are a symbol of longevity and luck. Some African cultures, bats are sacred. So it seems to be Western cultures that fear bats more, but it's not something that I've spent a lot of time researching.
And most of the people I know, actually, they want bats in their yard. I put up two bat houses trying to attract them.
Same.
And go ahead, please.
I'm sorry. I was just going to add that there is a common belief that all bats are vampire bats. The vampire bats, there's only three out of over 1,400 species that are vampire, that are sanguivore, that are blood-eating. I can't say the word properly. And only one of those would consume human blood, the common vampire bat. Those only live in Central and South America, all vampire bats. And a lot of that human-wildlife conflict there as well is due to the fact that there's ranching going on of livestock into natural areas, and those populations of common vampire bats have increased due to the presence of the cattle there. That then, of course, with people being nearby, people unfortunately can be affected as well.
So pretty much the takeaway is the bats around this area are not to be feared. They are very beneficial. They're useful. And that it would be good to protect their habitats. Michael Stewart writes an email that says, would your guest comment on the white nose syndrome threat to bats?
White nose syndrome hasn't been found in Florida yet, thankfully, but it is something that is absolutely causing a huge decline in bat populations in North America. It primarily affects cave-dwelling bats, and it's a really, really big problem in the Northeast and Midwest, but thankfully it's not been found in Florida. Mimi, do you have more detail on the syndrome?
Yeah, it's a fungal parasite that I may have mentioned. It affects bats in torpor in cave hibernacula primarily, and it basically forces them to kind of come out of that hibernative state to exert a lot of energy that they normally would not. And it is, especially in the Southeast, not here in Florida, but in the Southeast of the United States, is causing a lot of bat declines in populations of certain bats, like the little brown bat, and is definitely a cause for concern. And people that are going into caves for any reason for recreation need to be very, very careful in terms of sterilizing anything that may have come into contact with them, with, you know, in terms of their clothing or shoes, et cetera, when they are entering into caves. And if you don't need to go into a cave, I would say just avoid doing that. To prevent the spread of white nose.
Absolutely. Thank you. And I want to thank you so much. We only have less than a minute left. If you want to give us some contact information, just in case our listeners want to contact you and have more questions, Shannon?
Sure. You can always call our extension office in Polk County at 863-519-1051. And I will share my email address with you in case any of your email listeners would like to contact me.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And Mimi?
Absolutely, yeah. I can definitely give you my email address if people have questions.
Is there a phone number that they could reach you at, or do you, or?
No.
Okay.
I'll give you my email.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We've all enjoyed learning more about bats, and join us in 2 weeks for the next Sustainable Living Show.
Thank you for having us.
Okay. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Sustainable Living Program on WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Stay tuned for Radioactivity. Maria Neuwe.
viedo, usa ore moyo ganderia, Maria Nivea.